You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Qui-Gon Jinn would never join you.
Don't be so sure, my young Jedi. You forget that he was once my apprentice, just as you were once his. He knew all about the corruption in the Senate, but he would never have gone along with it if he had learned the truth as I have.
The truth?
The truth. What if I told you that the Republic was now under the control of the Dark Lord of the Sith?
No, that's not possible. The Jedi would be aware of it.
The dark side of the Force has clouded their vision, my friend. Hundreds of senators are now under the influence of a Sith Lord called Darth Sidious.
I don't believe you.
The Viceroy of the Trade Federation was once in league with this Darth Sidious. But he was betrayed 10 years ago by the Dark Lord. He came to me for help. He told me everything. You must join me, Obi-Wan. And together, we will destroy the Sith.
I will never join you, Dooku.
It may be difficult to secure your release.
Well, welcome everyone to Trek FM's local watering hole. I'm so excited to be here tonight. Guys, we are going to be continuing talking about our Star Wars look back at all of the films as we're getting ready for Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. But before we do that, we had a really big trailer that came out, and that happened during Comic-Con. We had a bunch of them, but the one we're going to talk about tonight, before we jump into anything else, is the Batman v Superman trailer. But before we do that, I need to introduce the guys hanging out with me in the 602 Club tonight. And Bruce, it is great to have you back here in the 602 to talk some Star Wars.
Yes, I am so ready to talk about Star Wars and have some death sticks.
Star Wars. We're always talking about Star Wars. Yeah, all right. John Mills, just save me. Just come on, bro. Make me
what,
stop.
Save you? See, I have actual death sticks, Bruce.
Oh.
I have... with me, candy cigarettes.
Oh, that, nice.
And
yeah.
So, now you're making me want them, and I they're out of reach. So, well
John,
played,
you said
sir.
You were
turning
quit.
Me to the dark side.
You told me you were going to quit.
Oh, come on. Candy cigarettes. I can't walk away, man. It's my one vice.
So sweet.
Oh, man. Oh, goodness. Well,
sweet Carolina sugar.
Woo-hoo. Oh, so nice. Yeah, so good. So good. Goodness, that leads into another song, too. I'm just going to stop. Batman v Superman trailer. What did you guys think? First reactions watching through it. I was unfortunately not at home. I was actually on a ferry in Seattle because it was my birthday that day. And I'm on the ferry trying to watch this trailer on my phone. So, yeah, it wasn't quite the same as everybody getting to watch it like, you know, on their TVs or their computers. So what did you guys think?
I thought it was insane. You're saying about being on the ferry. You know, anytime these things come out, it's always when I'm at work and I have to go and close my office door and I can't pump up the sound too loud or anything. And I got people knocking on the window. But I mean, so I had to watch it a couple of times just to get it. But it was, you know, as a kid watching Super Friends and reading comics after that, I used to think, wouldn't it be great to see Superman and Batman in a movie together? But that will never happen. And then to see that trailer blew me away.
Yeah. As long as we were all away from home, I was actually in the car on the way to see the Minions movie with the family. And I, you know, I'm looking at my phone and I see the announcement. And I'm like, oh, I got to do this. And it was some slow sell spot.
Oh,
so I'm sitting
that.
There and it kept stalling like as Holly Hunter's talking. And I'm like, shush. I got to try this.
Respect the Hunter. Come on, Internet.
I had to restart it so many times that on the last go, thank goodness it worked, because I looked at my wife and I said, okay, I promise you, this will be the last time you have to hear this opening. If it doesn't work, I will wait until we get home. And fortunately, it worked. I was giggling by the end of it. It's a fantastic trailer.
So my wife is huddled there with me as we're on the ferry and we're watching it together, and she's a fan of this stuff as well. I mean, not as ardent, obviously, as I am, but she likes this stuff, which is great. And so she's watching it with me, and it just was blown away as much as I was. It looks like everything that I wanted. I just felt so vindicated personally. I think Zack Snyder completely gets these characters. I think that they're using all the things that people might have had an issue with in Man of Steel to create a really interesting story with Superman and with Batman and, of course, Wonder Woman. And that was one of my biggest freakout moments. Forget Batman and Superman. Wonder Woman was on screen, and she was kicking some ass. Looked awesome.
She wasn't in it for very long, but what she was in there for was pretty cool. Like, giving us a taste of her clanging the gauntlets and having the big explosion afterward. I was kind of like, oh, that's nice. That's pretty cool. And she takes that one hit, and she smirks at the end of it. It was very sort of like Bruce Lee-esque, where it was like, ah, you hit me. Now you suffer. I was like, yeah, all right. Getting in the mix of things. That was nice.
Yeah, it looks like maybe she'll just be in maybe one big battle scene. From the trailer, it doesn't look like, you know, we saw different angles or different situations she would be in. But, yeah. I mean, the movie is called Batman versus Superman. But the thing I really liked about the trailer was the different approach that they're taking with Superman as compared to the old movies where Superman shows up to the world, everyone accepts him. But in reality, you have somebody like that comes in the world, people are going to freak out. And it's just like what Martha Kent says, you know, people are going to hate those things that they don't understand. And I think that's a really good, interesting, realistic take on what it would be like if somebody from Krypton with those kind of superpowers were in this world. People are not going to readily accept them.
I liked that this trailer mimicked the Man of Steel trailer, that they had one of the Kent parents say something that everybody was like, what? Which, you know, that conversation continues, but the same thing happened in the Man of Steel trailer when Paul Kent was like, you know, maybe to Clark's question, should I let them just die? And in this one, you know, she's saying, you don't owe this world a damn thing, you know, you never did. And my guess is that she follows that up with another statement about something else going along with that. But I just thought it was really interesting because it also, I think it respects how a mother feels when their child is attacked, you know, for no good reason. She knows her son. She knows what he was trying to do. And I'm sure she's feeling defensive about her son and the fact that people are attacking him when he did the only thing he could do, which was try to protect as many people as possible on his first day on the job, fighting, you know, more than one super person at a time.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. And I think also that if the trailer is any indication, if we get something that truly plumbs the depths of what is, you know, the themes that they're going for, like truly gets into the nitty gritty, and the trailer has me every, you know, gives me every reason to believe they will. But this is the type of sequel that can sort of retroactively redeem certain people's lower opinion of Man of Steel, if that makes sense. Like when you come out of a movie that's warmly but not greatly received, and then you have a sequel that builds and expounds on that story. Yeah, the example I would go to actually is Halloween 2, because when they introduced the you know, the revelation in that movie, spoiler alert, but the movie's like 40 years old, so, but when they have the big spoiler that Jamie Lee Curtis is actually Michael Myers' sister who was spirited away, like that goes back and informs the first one so that now when you watch the first one, it actually makes it even more thrilling and interesting. And so I think that this movie very much shows the potential to go back and raise the opinion of Man of Steel up for a lot of people.
Well, what I like about this too is I got to say, you know, Man of Steel does a great job of telling a complete story arc, you know, in that movie for Clark becoming Superman, you know, putting on the suit and getting to that point, kind of getting him to the place where we know he's going to be. But this one is just continuing the story, but not so much in the way that you're like, oh, like I had so much left over from, like my example would be the Spider-Man films, the Amazing Spider-Man. There were so many questions you're kind of left with at the end of the first one that you feel like you have to see the next one because you just want some questions answered. What I like here is they're just using the thematic story elements that they crafted in the first one to help inform the second one. So I really, really like it. I think that's great storytelling. And, you know, if you're going to create a cinematic universe, I think that's the best way to do it. Films need to feel standalone enough, but at the same time, be connected enough that, you know, you feel like you're rewarded for going to see each, you know, new film. And so the thing that surprised me, and I watched this a few times today to kind of get ready for us talking about it, Bruce seems to be talking to Wonder Woman, to Diana, when he's talking about that this person has the ability to destroy the entire planet and he has to be stopped. It felt like to me he was talking to her, and I thought that was really interesting because I think she's going to be the one, as Snyder has said, she's the gateway drug for the Justice League, and that somehow I think maybe she might be the one to help turn his opinion somehow. So I'm really interested to see that. That's why I think the dynamic between these three is going to be really interesting because they are the trinity of DC Comics and the ones that everything's built on, especially when you talk about the Justice League. So it's great that they're all three in this film and that she may have a small part, but it seems like to me she might actually be pivotal even though her role is smaller. And I think that's talk about a cool and getting that too, for because she said at Comic-Con that one of the things she said is that she's sophisticated as a character and she has a lot of emotional intelligence. So putting that together, I was like, okay, she's going to be the one that helps bridge the gap between these two guys and bring them together and help them see, as Alfred's saying, he's not our enemy, you know. And I love that I feel like I don't know if I'm the only one who called this, but that Bruce Wayne had lost a Robin already. And and so I love that, you know, that he already has lost the Robin. And you can tell why he would be so bitter in this world. So, all in all, this is a fantastic trailer. And I liked Man of Steel, so I don't have a lot of trepidation going into this film thinking, oh, well, probably won't be good. I have every intention of thinking this is going to just be, you know, brilliant.
Fair enough. I can tell you that... everybody I've talked to that was even lukewarm on Man of Steel saw this trailer and is hyped up for it. So it did exactly what a trailer is supposed to do, which is everybody wants to go see it now. So good job to them.
Yeah. And good job for not giving too much away, you know, in the trailer, you know, just giving you the enough to whet your appetite and just really make you ask questions instead of like the Terminator trailer where it gave away the biggest plot point of the movie.
Yeah.
And totally ruined it for you. Before we jump into episode two, just kind of want to remind everybody where they can find us. I'm Matt Rushing on Twitter. We've got Kessel Junkie John there on Twitter. Woo-hoo. And we've got Admiral_Rex there on Twitter as Bruce. You guys can find us there. We're also at Trek.fm online. We're at Trek FM on Facebook. We're at Trek FM on Twitter. We're all over the place, guys. So, and of course, this isn't the only show we do in the network. So if you haven't checked out all the other 20 shows that we have, check those out at Trek.fm. Now, guys, episode two. We did the episode one experience, but for me, the episode two experience was even bigger. So I'm kind of interested in hearing about, you know, y'all's first time seeing this film and what that was like for you. Bruce?
This was an interesting film for me to see for the first time. It stands out more than any of the other Star Wars movies. And one reason is because I actually read the leaked script weeks before it came out.
Bruce!
I know.
How dare you?
I am so sorry. But I'm not sorry because, first of all, when I read the script, I didn't know if it was the actual script or not. So I was going into the, it might not be. I thought it probably would be because it seemed it just seemed right. Like it would be something George would write. And when the movie started and the first couple lines of dialogue happened, I realized, oh my gosh, this is that script. I actually know this story. And I don't know why, but because I knew the story, it just made it so much better to watch this movie because I knew what was going to happen. And now this is different from what we talked about last time when I started reading the episode one novelization. It was a different experience for me because I was expecting more of the scenes that were in the novel, which were not shown in the movie. So there was some disappointment. But going from the script to what it actually is going to be in the movie and seeing that movie, it just made it more intense. Like I could maybe concentrate on more and I'm hearing the story for a second time, but I was getting so excited that I really had to use the bathroom. I had to pee so bad. And this is why I remembered it. Because I was sitting there the whole time saying to my wife, I've got to go so bad, but I can't leave the theater. Even to the point when the movie ends, I'm not going to leave during the credits. I have to hear that music all the way through. But man, once that ended, I ran to the bathroom and all was good.
He turned into Austin Powers at the end.
Yeah, baby.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, for my first time, episode two will always be the movie that I remember, not just for being, you know, a Star Wars fanatic, but it was the first movie where we bought tickets digitally before the showing. So there was no campout factor. And we went, of course, to a midnight showing. It was my two cousins. They are brothers and myself. We went to the midnight showing. Packed house. Everybody was there. I remember the theater manager coming up to the front and saying, so what does everybody think about the title? And some people were playing along. Like some people were like, yay. And some people were like, boo. And then one guy in the back just goes, just start the damn movie. And the rest of us said, yeah, what that guy said. I can honestly tell you, there's a little bit of a heartstring story with the movie where that was very cathartic. But overall, my reaction to the movie at the end, my cousin, Robert, who was there with me, said it best, where as the movie ended, he said, I honestly don't know how he's going to top this for Sith. Well, not he didn't say Sith, but for the next one. And I looked at him and I thought about it for a second. I was like, yeah, that was really satisfying. And like we just basically spent the next half hour talking about how it hit all of the notes that we wanted. We really liked the pacing. We really liked the action. We really liked where it went. And so, like, I came out, you know, rip roaring happy with this, like, right out of the gate.
Same here. I remember going to my parents' house because they were babysitting. And they said, so how was it? I'm like, it's the best Star Wars movie ever. Which is weird how time goes on. It's like, but now I don't look at it that way anymore.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, for me, I'm like you, John. This was my first time for a Star Wars movie, you know, getting the tickets digitally. And I did something I've never done before and I'll never do again. But I saw a movie 6 times in 1 day. So
I'm still trying to work out the math on that.
Yeah, I started with the midnight showing. So first part of the day. And it was so much fun because I was one of the biggest screens in Dallas. Actually, it was the biggest screen in Dallas. And I was in line, obviously, for a very long time and surrounded by these great Star Wars fans. And this guy had made an Obi-Wan costume himself that looked so good. It looked like he stepped out of the movie. And we're awesome. Just hanging there. Yeah, so I'm hanging out with Obi-Wan Kenobi the whole time. He even had one of the Force Effects lightsabers and everything. So guy
those
was legit.
Are awesome.
So saw the movie then, went to bed, got up, was at the theater, and we only had one theater in Dallas that had digital screens, which was a big deal because this was obviously the first movie to be filmed digitally on digital film and then released that way as well. And so I alternated between screens all day. And so I would, you know, watch it in one and then go get in line in the other. Watched it all day. My friends came to the very last show and I was sitting with them and they were like, how can you still be watching this movie? And I'm like, because it's so good. And then I remember, too, I had to go to the bathroom. I'd seen it, you know, five times by this point. So I go out, and the film critic, one of the big film critics in Dallas who worked on the TV station that my mother loved to watch, was out there, and I stopped and talked to him. And he didn't really like the movie that much, and I told him my story. And I ended up being on the news that day. Yeah, so for being the crazy geek who had seen the movie, you know, like four times already, and it was like, you know, 3 p.m. So, yeah, that was an experience that will never be topped, just because it wasn't as expensive then. And I was like, this is a one-time deal, and it's Star Wars. So I'm doing it.
I have a question for you. What did you eat through the day? Did you eat nothing but movie concessions through the day, or did you take like a lunch and a dinner break?
Actually, you know, I'm trying to remember. I actually did.
You blacked out from so much soda.
Yeah, no. I think that I was able to leave the theater for enough time to pick something up. That or somebody brought me something, actually. Either one of those things happened. I can't remember. It's obviously a long time ago now. That was my episode 2 experience. And I, you know, obviously that can't be topped. And I would probably never do that again. But it was Star Wars. And, you know, as far as we knew, this was going to be the last trilogy we ever got. So, you know, I figured I'll never have this opportunity again. You know, so you seize it. And I did. So, yeah, 6 times, 1 day, midnight to, you know, after midnight the next day. So,
wow.
So
that's dedication, man. That is dedication.
So at that point, would you say that you liked it better than episode 1?
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, nothing at that point could have topped Yoda fighting, and just the movie in general, you know, and everything about it was, I felt like, in a lot of ways, I felt like it was a step up. But, you know, as I look back, my rankings are a little bit different now. I actually have a lot more respect for episode 1 than I used to. You know, as my fandom has grown and I've gone deeper into the saga, I think, yeah, there's just been a lot that's changed about the way I think about them in general. And so I actually kind of like all of the Star Wars movies. There are just a couple that I hold in a little bit higher regard than the others. So,
sure.
Yeah. Watching this movie the other night, my wife and I, we watched it again, and I was rewatching some of it today, and I was really struck by the fact that Anakin is this kind of wunderkind. You know, and this whole idea that, you know, he knows from the moment that he reaches the temple in The Phantom Menace that there's something special about him. You know, Qui-Gon's already kind of mentioned that. I think he picks up on the idea that there's something special about him. And I'm pretty sure he's heard thrown around in the last 10 years of his training, the Chosen One. How much has that got to screw with a kid, just in general? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
I do. And something that I've thought about, you know, in the intervening years is, everybody always says, you know, write what you know, those sorts of things. The prequels, and I think it really started to come into focus with episode 2, the prequels are the most autobiographical works that Lucas has done. Because if you follow Anakin's arc, he comes onto the scene, nobody's seeing him coming, and then he's a wunderkind, but he doesn't know what to do with it, and he's overwhelmed and feels a bit trapped. So episode 2 is sort of Lucas communicating how it felt, I think, to have burst onto the scene with American Graffiti and then Star Wars. And, you know, he's basically just this young Turk out of film school, and all of a sudden he's regarded as, you know, like king of the world. And I think that definitely informs where he took the Anakin character. And I think also, you know, just the fact that Obi-Wan calls out his arrogance, and Yoda says, you know, he's like, tut tut, you know, all of the Jedi are being arrogant right now. And I took that as sort of like a little nudge on Windu in that scene. But I think that scene in specific really lays out that Anakin is arrogant and it is a character flaw, but how can he not be? Since, like you said, he's been told, you know, you're the savior, you're a great guy, you're going to be fantastic all the way through. How does that not sort of like warp your thinking about yourself?
Yeah, when a human being's told they're Jesus their whole life, but they're not really Jesus, it means they can't handle it, you know?
Right. Yeah,
and there's Anakin sort of an overload situation. Can't handle his saviorship.
Yeah.
Well, it's also saying, okay, yeah, you're Jesus, but you're not. You got to play by our rules. You're not ready yet. And it's like, how?
Oh, that's
true.
He's
constantly being held back. Of course, he mentions that several times, and that even goes back to episode one. He's a slave. He doesn't have control of his life. He can't. Of course, he's a kid, but, you know, his mother is held back. He goes to the Jedi Temple. He's held back. He's got all this ability, all these things he can do, but he, you know, you've got to hold back. You've got to play by our rules, and that can mess with you.
That's a great point.
It reminded me, honestly, I think this speaks even more to today, of this. Anakin has this sense of entitlement because of who he thinks he is. And in some ways, who he's been told he is. And at the same time, Obi-Wan is basically trying to say, no, you have to earn that. You know, all Jedi do, no matter who they are. Even Yoda had to earn this, you know. And so Obi-Wan's just trying to raise him up in the way a child should be raised so that, you know, when he is off on his own, he's not going to go nuts, you know.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I think that if there's any failing on the part of Obi-Wan, especially in the context of this film, is that he isn't enough of a father figure. He isn't enough of a steady hand. And, you know, like, obviously it's 10 years later. You just see him, you know, take Anakin under his wing in episode one, and then in episode two, Anakin's basically on the verge of being a Jedi. But Anakin's behavior is directly traceable back to Obi-Wan. And I think they call it out specifically in the novelization. There's sort of like a mixed message, a mixed signal that Obi-Wan sends to Anakin. Because, and they had, you know, it was so funny in the preview and in the movie where Anakin jumps out of the speeder to fall down and grab Zam Wessel, right? And Obi-Wan, you know, sort of like chides him and is like, oh, you know, gosh, you can't control this kid. When Obi-Wan, just mere moments before, jumped out of, you know, a 60 billion floor skyscraper to grab onto a droid that he had no idea of where he was going. And it's like, Obi-Wan's setting an example that he doesn't want Anakin to follow. He's basically saying, do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, and I think but I think part of that is that Obi-Wan's earned that because he's a Jedi Knight, you know, and
yeah, but part of being a parent is showing having the example for your kid.
Right. But at the same time, I also see part of, I think, what happened with Obi-Wan was he wasn't enough of a father. He was too much of a brother.
Yeah.
And that was the big difference. Because, you know, Anakin needed that firm hand. He needed to be taught what was right. And he needed to kind of have that humility instilled in him and that patience instilled in him as a Padawan. And you can tell that's what Obi-Wan is trying to do. You know, Anakin's just in those turbulent teen years where he's being petulant, and it doesn't help that all of his life he's been told, hey, you're special, you know? And so again, he feels like he should be treated in a certain way. He has this self-importance about himself. He has this huge sense of entitlement that I am the chosen one, therefore I should already be a Jedi Knight. You know, basically that's what he was saying to Padme. You know, Obi-Wan's just been holding me back. I'm so much more powerful than him. I should already be a Jedi Knight. You know, like, he feels like he's entitled. And what a interesting message, especially as we moved into this new century, and as we move forward in it, because talk about that arrogance. It's definitely a flaw more common in people, even the older ones, not just the younger ones. So
that's a valid point. I think also, I mean, the theme of the father figure, of course, echoes throughout, you know, all six films. And I think that an interesting parallel that's hard to overlook is you have Django and Boba, and I think that for me it's endlessly interesting to compare, you know, the way you see Django raising Boba, which is, you know, a really strict but very, like, it's almost like Boba Fett gets the type of you know, childhood that Anakin should have. You know, granted, he has to grow up really quick, you know, after this movie, but Boba Fett sort of has the father figure that Anakin should have had, because he should have had a very strict father figure in his life that said, okay, no, all right, this is how we're, you know, and not let him run rampant, because, you know, again, Obi-Wan sort of like chuckles at Anakin's indiscretions. Like you said, like, you know, like he's a big brother. And so, well, I think the Django parallel is very, very interesting with Obi-Wan.
And even when Obi-Wan brings up his concerns to the council treats him with this like, but he's the chosen one, so just let it go. You know, that's what Mace says, but isn't he the chosen one? You know, and it seems like the only one who's kind of on his side in that conversation that was so important to him about when he's trying to talk about his Padawan, Yoda again says the council is confident in its decision.
Yeah.
He doesn't say I'm confident in our decision. He says the council is confident. And yeah, he agrees with Obi-Wan that the arrogance is flowing through the Jedi, even the older ones. And so again, picking up on those little hints that Yoda gets what Obi-Wan's laying down, but he's on the outs in some ways. Like, he doesn't have the ability to sway the council, I feel like, and to kind of back him up. And I thought it was really interesting, too, because what Obi-Wan's trying to instill in Anakin is wisdom. He has all the knowledge he needs, but he hasn't been able to push that into wisdom, as Dex says. You know, I would think the Jedi would have more respect between, you know, between knowledge and wisdom, you know. So I think that's a really interesting thing, because Anakin has it all in his head, but it hasn't made its way to his heart, you know. And that's where the disconnect is. And that's where the arrogance comes in, because he doesn't have anything to temper his power. And that's what Obi-Wan's trying to instill. And I got to give it to Obi-Wan. I don't think he planned on having a Padawan anytime soon, right after becoming a Jedi Knight. It got thrust upon him.
Well, he took it. Don't give him that out. He took it on because he made the promise to Qui-Gon.
Yes, but I still don't think that was, I mean.
No, he definitely wasn't. What he should have said was he should have insisted that he be taken on by somebody else. But, you know, of course, he later says, I thought I could train him just as well as Yoda.
Yep.
I was wrong. But he's taken, spoiler alert, that happens in Return of the Jedi.
But he's taking on the Chosen One, which it's not like, oh, he's just taking on a Padawan. He's taking on the Chosen One. That's a huge responsibility. I mean, did he really feel like he was up to that task?
But it also calls into question the council itself, because couldn't the council have said, fine, we'll train him, but not you, pal. Somebody else has to take this kid on. You know, like, why didn't the council step in and say, you're not ready, okay? We'll take
care
of
this. Yeah, I never understood that, because you would think Yoda or Mace or somebody would have trained the Chosen One and not, oh, Obi-Wan, who hasn't trained anyone, who now lost his master. So, yeah, you take the Chosen One.
Yeah, you just became a knight, and we give you a kid. Here you go, buddy.
Yeah,
it's
but
a two-for-one day.
I think it ties into their whole, I think, core philosophical problem with the Jedi is their reliance on the will of the Force. Like, they're not, the council seems not to take the opinion that their actions are going to have consequence, that basically it'll all work out the way it's supposed to no matter what. And in a sense, I guess it does, but I think that if the council had acted differently, it would have worked out the same way, but probably a little bit nicer for all involved, if that makes any sense. Like, they chose path A when they really should have chosen path B. And I think that first splitting point is where they gave Anakin to Obi-Wan.
Yeah, in some ways, they've become so Calvinistic that they don't realize that there's also free will. You get to make right. choices, and those choices have consequences. And yeah, it all might kind of, it'll all work out for the plan in the end of the Force, but you also have to make the best choice as well, you know? And
right.
so yeah, that's a very, I love that thought. And again, it kind of goes to, there's so many different types of spiritual themes that run through the series.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, George is very smart in the way that he crafts that. So I really like that. Well, I wanted to talk to you guys. Watching through the movie, I was struck specifically this time because we've talked so much, of, especially about Qui-Gon when we did episode one. And then, of course, seeing some more of Qui-Gon and his impact through the Clone Wars. I really feel like Obi-Wan is so much like his old master, especially in this movie. And he is differentiating himself, too, with the way that the rest of the Jedi kind of work. And for me, it's all encapsulated in the scene where he goes to see Dex. And I love that because Obi-Wan has friends in low places. You know, he trusts people and their experience in life and their wisdom about life that I feel like the other Jedi have kind of missed. You know, they're in their ivory tower and Obi-Wan's a man of the people. I love that about this character.
Well, I think Dex also was a welcome return to, now, I love episode one. You know, listen to the previous episode where we were discussing it and you'll know that. But I think that episode two, Dex in specific, represented a move back towards some of that whimsy that we all enjoyed so much about the original movies. Dex is a character that is just fun to have in there. He doesn't, you know, the character itself serves a purpose. The character itself needs to interact with Obi-Wan, but having a four-armed, you know, diner owner chef,
yeah,
like that's that sense of, oh, okay, this is kind of zany. I kind of like that. This is whimsical. This is somebody walking in one day and saying, he's a diner owner and he's got four arms. Okay, great. And they just make it happen. And it's like, that's, you know, I like that. That's Dex has always been, actually, I have his action figure around here somewhere, but he's always been one of my favorite characters as a result.
Yeah, and the environment is, you know, the diner's a fun place, yeah. the droid waitress, the whole aspect, even the customers in the background, you know, it has that whimsy to it. And it's funny too, because, you know, he's more reliable than the library, the Jedi library. He, you know, Obi-Wan got his information from Dex than he didn't get from the Jedi library. So,
right.
Well, and I love too, you know, that all plays into the arrogance of the Jedi. You know, the librarian tells him,
oh yeah,
you know, if it's not in the Jedi archives, it doesn't exist, you know?
Right.
And it takes the faith of a child to help Obi-Wan be able to find his wayward planet, which that is my favorite scene in the movie, I think, is when Yoda's like, lost a planet, Master Obi-Wan has. How embarrassing. How embarrassing. And like, he's just in, he is that Yoda. Like, that's the moment for me that Yoda becomes much more the Empire Yoda, where he's just whimsical and a little bit like crazy professor fun guy, you know, like he'd be great to hang out with. And I
yeah,
no wonder he teaches the younglings, because he's on their level and he treats them like he's on their level, you know, with respect. And like, I just love that whole scene. And yeah, that's so great to see that happen, that again, Obi-Wan is trusting people that the Jedi just pass by, you know, and wouldn't necessarily give any time of day to. And yet, you know, like Qui-Gon, he's learned to trust the pathetic life form at this point.
Yeah, so long as you mention that scene, though, I wanna say that in Generations, Star Trek Generations, I always loved the stellar cartography room, because I was like, wow,
yeah,
that is so
yep.
cool. I really loved it. This was the first movie since then where I loved the way they portrayed like a map of the galaxy like I remember seeing it for the first time. I was like, that is so cool. Where like Obi-Wan puts a little marble on there.
Yep.
And you're standing in the galaxy and can walk around and be like, well, the planet's supposed to be over there. And it's, I'm like, that is even cooler than Generations. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like I just, it blew my mind. It was such a simple concept when you think about it, but so, so cool. What I would give to have like an orb of stars that I could walk through and be like, well, here you go. It's over here and we're going to move over. Like that's
and have
so
that cool. music in the background that.
Yes. Yeah. John really outdoes himself with some of the music for this film. It's this film and the next one need complete scores. I'm so upset that they've never done that.
Yeah, I've complained about that for years that they have not given the complete scores of episode 2 or episode 3. I mean there are some cues from episode 2 that are just fantastic. Mm-hmm. Thing is it when you compare the original music from episode 2 with the original music from episode 1, like there's really a different voice to the music. It's one of the things that is always that initially irked me about the film was during the battle sequence at the end where it was really you could tell that they just spotted a bunch of stuff and stitched it together.
Yeah.
Because it's literally just battle music from episode 1 lifted and put together in different, you know, they took a couple of bars here that were previously recorded and put it together. And I think it makes just the loss of the complete score even more tragic because there are some original transition cues alone that are just brilliant. And really, he gets just this different feel of the film. And one of the things that I really love about the score is it introduces this sort of waltz theme that comes back during all of the, you know, the major transitions and everything that honestly sounds a lot like Vertigo. So even the tone of the film, the music speaks to that sort of doomed love, that obsessive love that's not a good thing. And I just think it's a brilliant callback to, you know, another movie, a Hitchcock movie about, you know, doomed love.
Well, and that also I think really speaks to the whole idea of the doom of everything that's happening. Like this is the spiral down, you know. And so the love is not just doomed, but everything's kind of doomed, you know, at this point. And it to me it's also really speaking to the idea of, I love how going back a little bit, how Obi-Wan is so wary of politicians. And, you know, there he says, I've noticed that politicians will do pretty much anything to stay in power. They'll say and do anything. And I feel like that attitude, even he kind of carries over into the Jedi Council when we get to episode 3. And so it's just really interesting because, again, that's a theme that's even more important now than it was then.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I think that, I think that it all ties in together because Obi-Wan's mistrust of politicians, but there's also, like, the love story itself deals with this idea, I think, the way I read it, that Anakin is not doing what he's supposed to do, and neither is the council. These Jedi are not acting the way that they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. They're not acting on their fears about the dark side. Like Yoda and Mace admit, you know, our ability to use the Force is diminished. It's like the dark side is messing with us. We're losing our mojo here, but they're not doing what they need to do to get it back. And at this, and so I think that that's, you know, very much illustrated by the fact that Anakin isn't focused on being a Jedi at all. He's focused on just himself and getting what he wants out of everything, and he wants it all. And I think that the Jedi are the same way. So I think that Anakin's arc really illustrates that the Jedi themselves have just lost their way. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, and there's when I'm thinking about that, there's no metamorphosis for the Jedi. They're stuck in that their dogma. You know, they're stuck in protecting the status quo. And they don't realize that the status quo has changed because the government that they've allied themselves with is corrupt. and it's been corrupt for a very long time. And, you know, that's what Dooku says, that you don't realize that the Senate is now in control of the Dark Lord of the Sith named Sidious. You know, like, you don't understand how far it's gone. Like, you're on the edge of the knife. And yeah, that's so interesting because nobody is where they should be. And the good characters that you see there that are could maybe do something about it are just lost in the quagmire. I mean, they're like Obi-Wan, Yoda, they're trying to kind of push in a certain direction, but they're not getting any help. And yeah, they're too little too late at this point. So yeah, it's really interesting to watch that play out. And it's sad to see that the council is so, the Jedi Council specifically, is so entrenched in their ways that it's only kind of those two, like Obi-Wan and Yoda, who can even see that might something be wrong.
Well, I don't take away from Mace, because Mace is the one that delivers the line to Yoda. You know, maybe it's time to tell the Senate that our ability to use the Force is diminished. And Yoda's the one giving a foreshadowing of his proclivity for keeping secrets from people, saying, you know, oh, no, only the Dark Lord of the Sith, you know, stands to benefit from knowing. So, like, they even know that, you know, the Dark Lord of the Sith is still in play, which calls back to the end of episode one. And, you know, Yoda's the one that's like, no, 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 don't tell him anything. But Mace wants to go and tell the Senate, you know, the Jedi are not 100% reliable right now. We don't know what's going on. So Mace sort of becomes a jerk by the time, episode three rolls around. But in episode two, I think this is Mace's last moment of 100% being virtuous before everything tips and he starts, you know, sliding down that slope.
That's the one time in the film where I felt like Yoda is still a step ahead of every one of the other Jedi, because he can see the ramifications of allowing that kind of information out with the Dark Lord of the Sith still in play that Mace hasn't thought about. You know, so there's just that. I liked that scene because to me it wasn't about Yoda wanting to keep secrets. It was about Yoda realizing there is only one person that's going to benefit from that, and it is the Dark Lord of the Sith. And it might bring about our doom even faster if that's where we're headed.
But does, well, I think we could probably have a whole supplemental show debating the point of how irresponsible it is for Yoda not to give the Senate some sort of tip that, you know, hey guys, you should maybe be on your guard and start looking at things a little more suspiciously, because we think that, like, the Jedi are not telling the Senate everything, and that's not a good thing. I mean, if they're supposed to be acting in the interest of the government and the status quo, and then they're not sharing vital information, that's kind of a jerk move.
Well,
on Yoda's part,
goes to the whole thing is that the Jedi shouldn't be beholden to any government.
Agree.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, there's that whole other conversation that we've kind of had before, and it's just such a dangerous thing that they are trying to hold up this facade that's really become a facade at this point. And they're bound to it. You know, they've made their bed, and now they have to lie in it. And that bed gets destroyed, you know, by the dark side. So,
yeah.
Well, I wanted to jump in because we talked a little bit about the idea of the love story. And this is the part of the film, I think, that most people came out and they jumped on. But I also think that a lot of people didn't necessarily understand this movie is very much Camelot. You know, it is Anakin is Lancelot. He's the knight who shouldn't fall in love with the girl he does. Padme is Guinevere. It's the story of courtly love in the twilight of the Republic, which is Camelot. And I think it really works well on that level because it has that very over-the-top poetic nature to it that is getting across that it's not true, it's not virtuous. You know, there is something that's not quite right here, and therefore it requires just that flowery language you got to pour on it to make it seem like it's okay, you know? because they got to talk themselves into this. They know they shouldn't be doing it. Yeah, and again, it just plays out specifically with the story you saw with Lancelot and Guinevere, and that their love is going to be what brings down the Republic in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but I never really bought that they were truly in love. Like, I just felt it was strong infatuation that, I mean, you know, Anakin had already decided he was in love with Padme before he, you know, after 10 years of not seeing her, I'm already in love with her. I'm already in, you know, I need her. I'm passionate about her. I can't live without her. I mean, it's like this huge puppy love. And, you know, people say they don't feel like there's chemistry between the two. And I somewhat agree with that, but I think it's because they really weren't meant to be together. They were isolated. He never had an opportunity to really date. She never really had an opportunity to really date. She's so busy doing her job.
Oh, whoa, whoa. You forgot about Paolo and his dreamy eyes. He's an artist.
Yeah. Do you think that after he became Vader, he hunted that guy down?
Yes.
Paolo. Yeah. You once loved Padme. I will take you out now.
That's coming up in Rebels, by the way, I hear. So.
Yes, in the Darth Vader comic.
That would be perfect.
No, Bruce, I'm with you because I think what's so interesting is the way that this story is crafted. You know, Anakin loses his mother in this story, and then in a non-Oedipus way, I feel like he transfers that affection fully to Padme, and she's going to be his love and support now in life, now that his mother is
right,
gone.
Mother towards Padme, the no father in his life towards Obi-Wan.
Yeah, and
right.
And it, you know, what's so interesting is I realized that this is exactly what happened to me. You know, my dad left my family when I was going into college and was in college and almost done, and I took that loss and transferred it to somebody else, and it was a big mistake in my life. I shouldn't have done that. It led to me getting married when I shouldn't have, and just so I can completely understand why Anakin feels like he has this connection with Padme and why he wants her at his side and why it is a certain type of love, but it leads to that possessive type of love, not the true love, because he doesn't feel like he has anything else to hold on to. And that's really what's at play here. And that's why it doesn't ring completely true. And that's why I'm kind of glad that the love story doesn't play completely true, because it's not the embodiment of true love that we would get and say what we would think of is like a Disney movie, you know, like where they fall in love and they're going to live happily ever after. No, that's not this story. This is Lancelot and Guinevere, where they bring down the Republic with their illicit love that shouldn't be.
You know, I have a first and foremost thing, you know, sharing a story like that. I mean, that's, you know, thank you. You know, I know that there's somebody out there that, and I know that we here too, you know, I'm not saying not us, but like, you know, sharing something personal like that, that's, you know, thank you. But on top of that, I think that there is very much something to that. Absolutely. I think that Anakin has an infatuation with her because she is, at the beginning of the film, she's a callback to when things were simpler, when he was just a kid.
Yes.
So there's that initial hook. And he probably could have worked through that, but then he does lose his mother, and it becomes full on, I gotta be with you. And I think you're right, Matt, and Bruce. It's that transference of like, I need this in my life. I can't be by myself. Anakin is a person who can't operate on his own. He always needs somebody else around him. And I think that there is a one line in the entire movie. And the thing is, I saw this when they re-released it in IMAX. If you remember, this was one of the first movies that did that.
Yep.
I saw this in IMAX, and back then they had to cut the film for IMAX to run it. And they wound up cutting they cut the one scene in the beginning, which was unfortunate. But they cut a couple of lines from the fireplace scene. And the one that they cut was where he said, you know, that kiss is like a scar on my heart. It's this clumsy attempt at poetry. And I have two views about it. One, if that line had been cut before the final film was released, people react differently to the love story. Two, with it in there, I think that what makes people very uncomfortable about the Anakin Padme courtship is that it's not cool the way that the Han Solo courtship is. You know, Han and Princess Leia are sort of not doing this sort of like, you know, quippy, sort of like sarcastic, like, yeah, well, you know what? You're a stupid head. You're a stupid. And he's like pulling her pigtails and they're, you know.
Well, yeah.
You know, and then they find out they're in love sort of
George
thing.
George is doing It Happened One Night with, I mean, that's what he's pulling at. He's pulling at that classic they hate each other thing
right.
that's been playing out in romantic comedies for, you know, years right. and years and years.
Whereas Anakin and Padme are literally those, I mean, okay, look. I know that not a single guy listening to this wants to admit this, but you wrote stupid poetry for people and you said dumb things to try to prove your devotion to a girl. And you were clumsy and you were awkward and you were awful. And you, if you had a time machine, you would go back and kick your own self in the face. I know I would. I'll lay that right out there. I did all of those things, and it's like if I could go back to that young man, I would just throttle him and be like, "Oh, get your act together."
Speak for yourself, John.
But okay. Now, see, Bruce, I know you know there are outliers. There are people that the exception that prove the rule. So, of course, I accept you from that. But
no, actually, I was Anakin at 20, and when I was 30, I became Han. But keep going.
There you go. Yes.
There Perfect. You go. Yeah.
I think that's a natural progression, though. But I think that on some level, playing armchair psychoanalyst here, I think that on some level, there is a rejection of the love story because people don't like to be reminded of those awkward doofuses they used to be. And I think that the Anakin behavior reminds you of when you were 15 and you like drew a little flower poem for, you know, Susie, what's her name? And it's like you find something like that laying around. You're like, oh, geez, I don't want to remember those things. And I think on some level, that's why people.
I agree 100%. I mean, I remember watching that and feeling, oh, my gosh, this is so awkward. But that's how it used to feel when I used to try to do these things.
Well, exactly.
And again, it's the difference between the courtly declarations of love that they have here and the quippy one-liners that you have in the original trilogy, you know, and again, that whole It Happened One Night kind of relationship. We hate each other, but we're going to get together in the end because we really love each other. And that's fun. This is just, it's a different era of storytelling, which makes sense because George is in the prequel era and we're in a different time and a different place where the Republic still stands and everything is a little bit more heightened. Everything is a little bit more polished for, as Obi-Wan would say, a more civilized age, supposedly. So I think that's really where this love story takes place, and people were just expecting more of them to be like Han and Leia, but that's not where we are. This is the Shakespearean love story, not, you know, the romantic comedy from, you know, the last 100 years.
Yeah, well, and that's a great, just to sort of cap it off, I remember reading an interview with Christopher Lee, Star Wars Insider, probably, where somebody, you know, said, you know, well, you know, they criticize the acting in these movies right now. You know, what do you think of those criticisms? And he said something that I thought was, and I've held on to the line ever since, where he said, people forget that method acting is a method, it's not the method. And he went on to talk about how the prequels especially are melodrama. They're not the naturalistic, this one in specific, is not the naturalistic way of acting that we're used to with a Leonardo DiCaprio or a De Niro or a Bale, like losing 400 pounds or putting on 30 pounds or any of those sorts of things. This is supposed to be sort of like that, like you said, Matt, that sort of heightened emotion that, you know, calls back to a different time. So I just want to say that, like, even Christopher Lee was like, people don't get it. This is supposed to be sort of that over the top sort of emotion that's being portrayed.
Well, that really leads us into, I think, you know, this is a fast galaxy that we're in the prequels. And, you know, the original trilogy, George had to invent all the things he needed to tell that story. And it was a more self-contained story. It's a rebellion story. And it takes place on the outer reaches of the galaxy. You know, you're never in the... You're either in space or you're in small settlements on planets, or you're hiding away on an ice planet. I mean, all of these things, it's very backwater where all the battles are being fought. You know, this takes place at the height of the Republic. And so what George needed to tell these stories, it required new tools, and they worked alongside the old tools that he used. So, you know, for them, it was using model work with green screen, with blue screen, with all of these things, and putting it all together to create this bigger, more elaborate version of the Star Wars universe for where we're telling the story. And that's one of the things I love about specifically Episode 2. I love Kamino and how amazing it looks. Just the what they do there with some people don't, I don't even think they realize, but there's model work in there. There's CGI. There's all sorts of amazing things going on. And I was watching the behind the scenes where the voice for Tan Hui, she actually had a helmet on. So they had the eyesight line, but she was actually there giving her the lines, the person who was going to be the actual voice. And then when they were doing sight lines and everything, they would have her stand off the side, you know. So, like, they were doing all that they could. They were using the animatics, you know, that they had created so they could show the characters, like, when they were in a spaceship. This is what you're seeing. You know, like, they were using all the tools they had to try and create a film. And that's what I loved about the original Star Wars when I was a kid, because I got into the behind-the-scenes stuff, how George made them. And to me, this was just as exciting as... And so I really get upset when people trash the prequels because George was using a new toolbox with the old toolbox to try and tell his Star Wars stories, because that's what George has always done. He invents technology to tell the story the way he wants to tell it. And I mean, as he said on the extras, I push people farther than they think they can go, and then they keep surprising me by making it. So I keep pushing them farther, and that's what's made Industrial Light and Magic and everything that he's created the greatest effects house and the place you go if you want your stuff done for your films, because you know you're going to get done right. I think this movie, especially in its time, even now, it still looks incredible. Just incredible.
It does. And I'll say that as far as the effects go, the one effect that... because I went to Celebration 2, and I remember seeing the sort of like their effects sizzle reel that they came up with that I think was included in the original DVD release. I don't recall if it was included in the Blu-rays, but it was what they showed at Celebration. I remember just the one thing that stuck in my brain that completely blew me away and still does is the fact that Oliver Ford Davis, who played C.O. Bibble, was not on set. And they had another actor there in case they couldn't get him, who delivered his lines, and they were like, oh, wait, okay, we can get him. And they took a green screen with them, and they just had him match the pace and had him walk and deliver his lines and then matted him in later. And that, to me, was the most mind-blowing effect. I think that what people react to is that the CG backgrounds, when it falls apart, people forget that there were plenty of matte painting backgrounds in the originals. Now, Cloud City, when we were kids, and you know, there's the matte painting, like, it didn't really register with us because they did a lot of good sleight of hand, mm-hmm. And those sorts of things. But if you go back and you watch the original Cloud City look of, you know, when they're on the gangplank and you know, Han is just getting there being greeted by Lando, you can see, you know, that it's a matte painting. Or in a, again, in Empire Strikes Back, they have the commander telling the two guys, you know, two X-Wings per transport or whatever, and you can tell that it's a matte painting. Or Lando in Return of the Jedi walks with a matte painting Falcon. The digital matte paintings are just, you know, arguably used more extensively in these because he puts these characters in places where it's like, what else is he going to do? I mean, the Emperor arrived to the Death Star and it's a giant matte painting.
Yep,
and there's like two lines of people on either side. And it's just, you know, for me, it's I think that people just fixate too much on the effects. And to speak to the behind the scenes thing, I too like to see behind the scenes, but I often wrestle with the question of, has the curtain been pulled back too many times for us? Like, the reason the first Star Wars movies really wowed us on some level is because we didn't know how the magician did the trick.
Uh-huh. We believed it.
We know now. Yeah, but we know now. And so I think that's why you see this sort of like pendulum swinging back toward more practical effects and sets, because we know the trick, so we can't be fooled anymore.
I agree. You know, when I watch the movie, seeing so many behind the scenes, there's when certain scenes come up, I'm like, oh, that's a model. I know that was green screen. I know all the little bits and pieces, even to the point that they changed the Anakin reaching over and touching Padme. That was digitally changed, the way his hand reached over and touched her arm or her hand or something there on Naboo. And I think of that every time I see the scene. So I try to put that out of my mind to just watch the movie for what it is. But I feel like I know so much that it's almost like a director who says, I can't really enjoy a movie because I'm thinking about all the things that were happening that day and all the things I was thinking of what went right and what went wrong. It's almost that same type of thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that a little bit. But I was thinking, I just rewatched the extra and they were talking about the fact that they took some blue screen to London and filmed for half a day with Hayden and Natalie. And then out of that, they created the droid factory sequence.
Like, oh, yeah.
It just blows my mind that half a day of filming and you can create this whole amazing sequence. And that sequence still looks pretty good.
Today. It does.
I mean,
it
was, it's incredible the work that they put into that. And, you know, what I realized too is, you know, those CG artists, they're putting so much into it. I mean, you just watched the extra about creating Yoda digitally, how much work that George put them through to make Yoda. And, you know, you realize just like the Disney animators, these guys are actors. They're having to act to get the performances that they're getting out of these characters. And, you know, they're using digital stunt doubles all the time in this movie, and you can almost never tell unless you know, if you've seen the behind the scenes. You there's scenes there you just don't know that's not, you know, a stunt double doing the stunt. It's amazing, you know. So I think it's just an incredible amount of work that's amazing.
I just want to say, I want to get on my soapbox real quick because I've always wanted to say this. I get so tired of hearing people say actors on a green screen doesn't work. It doesn't allow the actors to really act. And they need to be in the environment. And I say poo-doo because being someone who's done acting, how many times have I done scenes or shows where I'm on a stage, I'm not in the desert, I'm not in that physical location. Lots of times I'm on a stage that's all black and I've got a black box for a chair, yet I can do that scene or do a monologue without actually physically being in the location. So you can act in a green screen and do it well. That's my stance on that.
Yeah, Bruce, I think that's actually a really great point in that. In some ways, the green screen acting and everything, it is back to stage work and using your imagination in a way that you haven't before. And, you know, I think that the actors that really pulled it off well in this film, you know, I think of Christopher Lee in the movie and the way that he's not fazed by any of it. He's just playing the part to perfection as Christopher Lee does because it's just another job of acting for him. He has no problems, you know, being on green screen, because to Christopher Lee, green screen is just like being on stage. And I think that's what's so amazing. And you know, those actors that really do that well, I think Ewan McGregor does it fantastically too in the prequels. I don't feel like he's ever really struggling too much with the green screen work. I think he's just sold out to the part. And so those characters, they really make it work. And yeah, I'm sure it is also a lot of fun to be the characters when you do have more of a set and you have something there too. I'm sure that's great and I'm sure it does help. But at the same time, you know, you're an actor. Your job is to pretend to be this character and to be able to use your imagination to bring a scene to life, whether there's green screen there or whether there's an entire full functioning set on the set of, you know, like The Hobbit, you know, where you have an entire set that you can walk in and out of and it looks just like reality, you know? So
yeah, I just to piggyback on that, I did go to school for theater, and one of the things was it was drilled into you when you would do the classes and everything. You would have like maybe some boxes and stuff like that, and you were taught you had to pantomime. Sell me on it. Convince me that you are in that scene. And so it does, you know, you had to direct yourself. And it was like, okay, how am I going to convince somebody that I'm holding a plate or, you know, doing some sort of, you know, zany thing with a feather duster or something like that? I don't even have a prop.
Yeah, it's acting 101.
Yeah.
102, okay, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you guys are way beyond me, but last thing I kind of really wanted to touch on is the dark side of this movie. And
yeah,
I thought it was really interesting. You know, Palpatine lost Maul as an apprentice, or at least he thought he lost Maul. That's a whole other
what?
Story.
Well, he lost him by this point.
Days, but yeah. But he picks up a new apprentice with Dooku, who's one of the lost 20 Jedi, and I am still a little miffed that George cut that small scene out of the library scene there, because I just think that it would have meant a lot to kind of explain just a little bit about Dooku's background, because we find out through the prequel novelizations and stuff that he was once trained by Yoda. And then he trained Qui-Gon, obviously, we find out in this movie. And, of course, so you see this progression of people being taught. And I just think having that, I don't know, it just made it a little bit richer, kind of knowing that he'd left the Order. And apparently there's only 20 people in 1,000 years who have left the Order. That's pretty impressive.
Well, that doesn't count people that failed out as Padawans.
Well, that's true.
But you know, the one thing about Dooku's character in this movie particularly that I always debate about whether it could be handled better is obviously Lucas is telling the story as if you don't know that Dooku is going to wind up being behind everything. Well, I mean, he's, you know, right. Palpatine's behind everything, but you know what I mean, for the purpose of this movie. And as a result, the thing that really should have left that library scene in where they explain the Lost 20 is I think it would have helped sell Dooku's betrayal better. And I think that on some level, Lucas knew that everybody was going to sit there and, you know, Mace Windu was like, oh no, Dooku was once a Jedi and stuff like that. And everyone's like, yeah, we know. We saw all the previews. We know that, you know, Count Dooku's the bad guy, okay? And so I think that he tried to transfer that shock moment to Yoda calling him my old Padawan. I think that was like he tried to transfer it that way, where it's like, oh my gosh, he was trained by Yoda, and I remember having that reaction of like, what, really? But you know, I that Lost 20 scene I think would have gone more to selling the drama of Obi-Wan later seeing him as a dark, you know, as a Dark Lord and saying traitor, you know, when he first walks in, because we would have had more fleshing out of Dooku than we had previous to that.
It's interesting too, to watch Dooku then and knowing that and especially rewatching it now, the arrogance that he has, that he thinks he can take on Yoda, that he's more powerful than Master Yoda. And I just laugh every time because to me, that scene, he gets his butt handed to him by Yoda and then pulls the whole like evil bad guy at a Superman film where you distract Superman by having to save people so you can get away because you're about to be taken down. He thinks he's all badass and he's just not. I mean, he is for a lot of other Jedi, and at this point he was for Obi-Wan, but he's just not as cool as he thinks he is. And I kind of like that he just gets it, you know, taken to him by a little green frog.
Yeah, he cares for these people. I think that, if you really want to drill down, Dooku gives away because he says, this is just the beginning. And he makes the thing fall, and Yoda has to distract himself and everything. And I think that, honestly, you could even take that scene, and I would not put this past Lucas to be one of those important foreshadowing moments of Dooku saying, fine, you care more about them than stopping me. And I think that that's basically how the Sith beat the Jedi, is through what could be described as distraction, but also... what Kurgan says to the Highlander, you know, like, what the Emperor says to Luke, your compassion is your undoing. Like it's, I think that one scene is, I don't think Dooku is playing to win. He's playing just to get away at that point.
Yeah. Well, and it is interesting because I was thinking to myself, you know, Yoda can just force push them out of the way of that and go back to his fight. I mean, he's strong enough to do that. He doesn't have to hold I think so, to force push the boys out of the way real quick. I mean, can take force lightning into his hand. I think that he's got the strength to be able to push the boys away. And
but couldn't you make the argument that Yoda is at this point out of practice a bit, not out of practice per se, but he's not used to going out and having a fight, you know?
That is true, yeah.
And so this is him coming out of retirement, and it's a bigger fight than he anticipates. And it's like, I need all of my concentration here, you know?
To me, I always just felt like Yoda had won because he says, he gets that arrogant look on his face. Fought well you have, my young Padawan, and my old Padawan, and I that it was over, like he was about to unleash hell, basically, and Dooku realizes that, and that's why he does what he does. But yeah, I think you have a good point in the sense that this is only the beginning. I can't see that the compassion of the Jedi is their undoing, because I think it's their lack of compassion for a lot of things that is their undoing.
Well, I think that their compassion for others is the wedge. I think that their compassion goes away. I certainly think so. By the time that the Clone Wars are over, but I really do think that it's one of those initial wedges, and I think that you can burn a virtue out of somebody, and I think that that's one of the things that the Sith do. But that's sort of, I think that another thing that people pick on the prequels for, and maybe even this one, is that Lucas hits on points and sort of lets you fill in between. And so in my, to borrow Chris's term, my headcanon, the compassion gets beaten out of the Jedi. They get so tired of caring for other people that it's just, they just want to quit. They're just like, ugh, and they're done. Even if it's not the Jedi in general, I think that Yoda definitely has, compassions for others and will always choose to save the innocent versus fight the bad guy.
Yeah. Why does Dooku, and this is, I still wrestle with this, why does Dooku tell Obi-Wan the truth?
That's a good
question.
Do
you really think that Dooku would have taken him under his wing and they would have taken out Sidious and then hopefully, basically, do you think Dooku thought for a while, like in Dark Disciple, that I need to turn to the dark side to try and take out what's wrong? To actually make things right, you know what I'm saying?
Bruce, I want to get your take on this before I blather on.
I think that Dooku thinks he is doing right and is not looking at it as light side versus dark side. I don't know if he... I mean, he is a Sith, and he does know that, but I think that he wants to get... Because the job of a Sith is to then become, take over the Sith and take the Sith leader and be the master and get a apprentice. And so I think he is looking at that at Obi-Wan, and by being truthful and honest, which the Jedi is doesn't always do, Dooku thinks that honesty might get him exactly what he wants out of Obi-Wan and take over and push Palpatine out of the way and put the galaxy the way it's supposed to be in his view of what should happen. Just the way Anakin's been saying how, you know, it needs to take one person to make the decisions and make right in the galaxy.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. I think that Dooku is arrogant enough, again, going back to the arrogance theme of the Jedi, arrogant enough to think, you know what, I can mess around with the dark side. And you know what? I'll get powerful enough. Hey, I'll get this guy Obi-Wan to come on board with me, and we'll overthrow Palpatine. And then the galaxy can be set right, and we'll burn out the corruption because the Senate just needs to go. And we, you know, so there really is, as Ki-Adi-Mundi says, you know, he's an idealist. And I think that, you know, idealism can blind you to the practicality of your choices.
And if he's going to get an apprentice, he's going to choose Obi-Wan because it would have been Qui-Gon, because Qui-Gon was his apprentice.
Sure. Now, here's a question. Do you think Qui-Gon would have turned with Dooku?
No.
No. I think if Qui-Gon had lived, a lot of things had been different.
I think that's three no's across the board then.
Yeah. I think it would have been really interesting, you know, if Qui-Gon had survived. So much, I think, would have changed for the saga. Because he was such a pivotal character. And I think, just think of Qui-Gon being the master of Anakin.
Yeah.
I think he would have had a lot more fatherly influence. He wouldn't have put up with his crap the same way he didn't with Obi-Wan. But at the same time, he was a great master. He's compassionate and caring and definitely led by example. So, yeah, I think that that's a great question. I have one more question, because Palpatine is a genius, obviously. I mean, this guy's been planning, he is playing the long game like crazy. He's been in power for 10 years now as Chancellor, which is quite a long time to keep getting reelected. And he's been placing all these things in place. You know, his plan gets Padme away, he leaves the Stooge in place, he gets Anakin away with her. This is my question. Does Palpatine have Anakin's mother stolen, Shmi kidnapped, so that he can use that to his advantage and make sure that she dies and just put one more nail in the coffin for Anakin of turning to the dark side?
I think it's... I have a hard time picturing him going and meeting with a bunch of Tusken Raiders and putting a plan together like that. But I think it's maybe the reverse of that. I think that Palpatine was waiting for the moment that something were to happen to Anakin's mother, and then the Tusken Raiders took her, and then he launched his plan to get Padme and Anakin alone to play that out.
Yeah, I think that he is a master of seizing the opportunity. I think that he is assisted. Again, Mace says, you know, that you know, the power balance is shifting, and Dooku even says, you know, the dark side of the Force clouds their vision. I think that at this point, Palpatine is firing on all cylinders. He can see some things that are coming, and he doesn't necessarily need to act. He can tell that something, you know, Anakin has a couple of leverage points, and he can roll with it. It later comes to, you know, bite him in the butt when the balance shifts again, but I think you're absolutely right, Bruce, that he just sort of takes advantage of something, knowing Anakin's weaknesses. And he would have done something if he had to, but I don't think that he had an active hand in what happened to Shmi, no.
Yeah, for me, it's always been in my head canon that, just like he has with Dooku using, you know, Jango Fett and the Kaminoans and Sifo Dyas and all of these things that he's also, because that plan is pretty elaborate, especially as we found out in the Clone Wars. I think that the same thing happened with Shmi, in that he just used intermediaries, because nothing ever, I mean, it takes so much to get back to him. He's never doing it himself. He's making other people do his bidding. So to me, that was always what happened, is that he saw that, yeah, that this is, because he knew too that the attack was going to happen on Padme. He's the one who suggests Obi-Wan and Anakin, and he's the one who set the other part of the plan. I mean, he doesn't know that Obi-Wan is going to be the one that's sent with on the mission for Jango Fett, but I mean, yeah, he's got enough of the plan so that he's kind of manipulating the council in almost that way to do things. So that's just my personal headcanon, and that's why I asked the question for you guys.
Well, everybody's headcanon is their own thing, but the one thing I will say to sort of deconstruct that sort of conspiracy theory is that it's one thing to woo Dooku, put Jango Fett in place, and then manipulate Sifo Dyas to order the clone army and do all of those sorts of things behind the scenes. But Anakin showing up when he does, there's, in my mind, enough of an act of randomness to make it not happen that way. You know, like, it's... there's not enough order to Anakin's behavior to indicate, you know, because his mother is captured before even the beginning of the film, really, because Anakin's already having dreams about her. So I don't know, but I mean, you know, if that works for your headcanon, who am I to bust it?
Well, guys, wrapping things up for you, I guess if you had to give Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, a rating, what would your rating be? And let's do one on, say, a either a 5 or a 10 scale to see where we kind of place this one. And this is a tough question, I think. So, Bruce, do you have a place that you might place? Do you have an idea of where you might place Episode 2 on that kind of scale?
If I did a 5 scale, I would say... 3.5 particles of sand.
It gets everywhere. I would say.
Wait, did you just get that? I would,
Matthew? No, I just. It just got funnier the fact that he went there and it was good. Yeah.
For me, I'm gonna go full on. I'll go 10 scale. And I will say, honestly, Attack of the Clones, based solely on the moment you see, it goes into overdrive the moment that you see Windu's foot fall in the hallway behind Dooku at
this
the Geonosian.
This party's over.
Yeah. That, from that scene forward, lifts it up from what it would have been, which is an 8, to, for me, it's a full-on 9 out of 10.
Ah, that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well... you know, I've been thinking about this all day, and I think that for me, this movie is a good 8.5 out of 10. I like this movie, and I think part of it is I respond to the Obi-Wan mullet in this film.
Yeah, how can you not?
I sadly wanted that hairdo, but I could never grow that hairdo. For some reason, I thought it was cool back then, you know, but Obi-Wan makes it work. And I loved getting to see all those Jedi in action that way. One minor quibble is that I feel like all of those Jedi could have easily beaten all those droids, especially when you see what they can do in the Clone Wars, when they and just a few clones take on, like, 200 droids all the time in that show.
Well, this is a practice round for them.
Yeah, this is a practice round. They lose a lot of Jedi more quickly than I would think, just against a bunch of, you know, droids. So, but that scene is just, it's so awesome. I mean, and the model that they made for that arena is so intricately beautiful. I just, that's a great scene. So, and then, Yoda whips out a lightsaber and all hell breaks loose. It's awesome.
They scrambled a lot of Jedi for that fight.
Yes,
and there were plenty
did.
that were out on assignment, and I would say that there were probably a fair number of Padawans in there too. So
yes,
that probably accounts for sort of these.
As we know, Barriss Offee was there, and if you notice, and as you look towards the Clone Wars, Barriss Offee is standing with Luminara in that meeting with Palpatine. So she is witnessing the corruption from the beginning.
Yeah.
So that really does inform where that character goes. So check out the Clone Wars because, her story gets real interesting.
Yes, but, it does.
Star Wars is not the only thing. Episode 2, The Awesomeness of the Attack of the Clones, is not the only thing we've been talking about at Trek FM the past week. So here is a quick look at some of the other things you've missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. Standard Orbit.
It wasn't so much, some down and dirty action, and stuff. It's more like Spock is in heaven and it's all good until he comes back, that kind of stuff. I think those are the lyrics.
Earl Grey.
We divide the ship into one of two ways. Port goes to port. I better not see any starboard guys on the starboard phaser target practice. You guys know which side of the ship you're on.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew, pew, pew. I promise you that.
To the journey! I can just hear the Earl Grey people screaming, measure of a man, measure of a man.
And you know what I would say to that? Death wish, death wish.
Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school. I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go with Silic and the Suliban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I think part of it, which is probably good, is that he's probably not familiar with what happened, in season one of Next Gen, aside from hearing stories here and there. So he's just like, whatever, I'm just going to get the story.
The 602 Club.
I think he's very much recreating that THX feel. And you may disagree with it. You may not think it's, it's great, but it's on purpose. He wants that world to be that way.
Let me just say, conceptually, I agree with that. In terms of execution, that's where I think he failed.
Literary Treks.
It's amazing to me, as I reread these stories, how much of it I just kind of think of as Deep Space Nine these days, even though it wasn't part of Deep Space Nine, the actual series.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969. That had its moment. It had its time. And there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
My absolute favorite thing about this episode is that this is a love potion only if it's between a man and a woman. They make it explicitly clear that if you touch two men or two women, they just become really good friends.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows, find out what we've been talking about everywhere in the Star Trek universe, and of course, a galaxy far, far away. And wherever you get your podcasts, guys, if you're an Apple user, help us out. John, what should they do if they want to help us out?
Oh, give us a 5-star rating. I mean, you want to. You will give us a 5-star rating.
Well, and you know why? It's because already right now on iTunes, we're a 5-star podcast, 27 5-star rating. So, boom. I mean, you just want to be added to that number. You can subscribe and you can give us a written review. All of those things really help us out. And of course, if you're not an Apple user, guys, we're everywhere. Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from the website and grab the RSS link as well. You can really be a part of our family with Patreon. And we are a listener-supported network, and one of the best ways that you can help us out bringing all of this content to you is to go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can support us coming to you each week and bringing these shows to you. Got some amazing perks. Actually, while we were recording this podcast, got some emails about one of the perks we're working on for the special Patreon members. We've got exclusive content such as producer credit, seats in the content development team. We're doing the Patreon roundtables. You'll be getting those. You'll be hearing the different members in the master feed. We appreciate you guys so much, because without you guys, we couldn't be bringing this to you. And find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. I really think the associate producers, the guys that help bring this show to you each week, And my executive producers of C. Brian Jones and Norman C. Lau, those guys are great. My associate producer, Ken Tripp, without his support, this show would not come to you, and it's all because of his work through Patreon, so really appreciate that. Guys, contact us. I mean, trek.fm/contact. Let us know what you think about the prequels, and maybe specifically what we talked about today. You could leave us a voicemail. If you didn't hear the show last week, well, you need to go listen to it, because you'll know if you leave us a voicemail, you're going to get a very special gift on the Babel Conference. So look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. Where can they find us on Twitter and on Facebook, John?
Well, Matt, they can find us on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find us on Facebook at TrekFM as well.
Well, and then, of course, if you want to interact with us, one of the best ways to do that is the listeners only group we call the Babel Conference, and only listeners who hear the shows know about it. So search Babel in the search field on Facebook, or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And that's a great place to visit anyway, because we got the show pages, all the links for everything there. Great place to be is trek.fm. Well, guys, I have to say I couldn't do these shows without you, because nobody wants to listen to me ramble on for over an hour and a half about Star Wars by
myself.
That's
what your wife says to us.
Yeah, it actually probably
she
is.
She begs us to come on.
She's like, please come on the shows. Bruce, tell everyone where they can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at Admiral_Rex, and I'm also now doing some writing on StarWarsReport.com, and I'm always in the Babel Conference.
And John, tell everybody where they can find you and about your 5-star podcast that everybody should be listening to.
Well, I can tell you that you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE, or KesselJunkie.com. I've gotten the writing bug again and churning them out.
Yes,
and
you can have.
Also, you can find me here on this network, Trek FM network, on Commentary Trek Stars with Mike Schindler, which certainly is a 5-star podcast. And you can also find me on another podcast with my buddy Craig, called Words with Nerds, where we talk about everything.
You guys really do. I mean, I listen to you each week, and you guys are talking about some of the strangest things that I've never heard of until I listened to your show. So,
if you don't give us guidance, we go everywhere.
Yeah, the tagline could just be, it's going to get weird.
Yeah, I like that. I'm writing that down right now. That's going to be on a batch of shirts.
Well, guys, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram at MRushing. I'm also on The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. I do Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Also interview authors, too, about their newest works in the Star Trek canon of books. And then you can find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, may the Force be with you.